from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Everybody says we need a better tax code. Few want to actually wade into that thicket. Last week, Michigan Republican Congressman David Camp did. He's chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. He laid out a big tax overhaul, a much simpler design, fewer breaks and deductions. Everybody says it's going nowhere, but it's a conversation starter, a conversation we need to have this hour on Point, a GOP plan for tax reform. Joining us today from Washington is Jason Fichtner, Senior Research Fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Jason Fichtner, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you again for having me.
And with us from Rochester, New York is David K. Johnston, investigative journalist and author, winner of the 2001 Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the tax code in the New York Times, now columnist for Tax Analysts and Al Jazeera America. He edited the new book, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality, out in April. David K. Johnston, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom.
It's wonderful to have you here. Thanks so much for joining us. Jason Fichtner, walk us in first, if you'd be good enough, to David Camp's proposal. What's he laying out here?
So I think it's important we start by understanding that tax reform really is a balancing act. You're trying to get economic efficiency, you're trying to have more simplicity and less complexity, yet you're also trying to balance out equity and some populism that the American people want. So in this plan, there are some things to cheer and some things to jeer. I think for everybody, what benefits is there are lower rates that taking the current 7-rate structure down to 2, or depending on your math, 3, a lower rate of 15% and then a 25% rate. But for those that are higher income, $400,000 individual or $450,000 for married, they would see a 10% surtax. So in other words, a 35% rate on the individual. Dave Camp does a lot of things that are interesting here for simplicity. He basically increases the standard deduction to $11,000 for individuals or $22,000 for married filers. But he gets rid of the deduction for state and local income taxes. In fact, his idea is that more people would not have to keep records and itemize deductions. More could now use the expanded standard deduction instead. He also gets rid of the alternative minimum tax, which is starting to snare more and more middle-income tax filers. He does something that's also interesting. President Obama recently is going to pull from his budget request the change CPI. Dave Camp actually puts it into the tax brackets. That's actually considered a tax increase as the brackets would grow more slowly, exposing more income to tax from inflation. So there's a lot of things in here. The corporate tax also gets lowered from 35% to 25%, which will help with corporate competitiveness. But to do that and to lower the rates and keep sort of this being tax neutral, Dave Camp gets rid of a lot of business things that they actually like. So he puts a new excise tax on big banks that are considered too big to fail. He repeals the last in, first out, what's called LIFO, from an accounting which raises taxes. There's some capital cost recovery and increasing depreciation schedules, which adds cost to business. But the idea is that by lowering the rate, it should balance out for most corporate taxpayers.
A lot of deductions go away, Jason, including some of the mortgage interest deduction that so many people use, but not all of it. What would he do with that?
So that's correct. So for people who are listening out there who currently have a mortgage, nothing changes for you. What changes is going forward, if the bill would be passed, for those who would get new mortgages afterwards, he would limit the deductibility of mortgage interest to a mortgage value of $500,000 or less. Currently, you can do it up to $1 million. But it wouldn't change for current people holding mortgages, just those going forward. And I think the important point there is to realize that a lot of people have claimed now that the mortgage interest deduction is really a tax giveaway for wealthy people. Why should we be subsidizing houses that are bigger and more expensive or second homes for vacations? Let's focus it and narrow it for those who really need it. The middle class have a generous level at $500,000 and use some of those savings to lower their tax rates overall for everybody.
Charitable contribution deductions also sharply curtailed.
Yeah, there's a lot of things here that eliminate in some ways and reduce the ability to deduct charitable contributions, but also still in some ways support it. And one of the ideas that you do see is by actually having a higher standard deduction, Dave Camp is trying to basically say, if you want to give the charity, please give the charity, but you shouldn't necessarily do it for a tax break.
So if you don't give more than 2% of your income, no deduction on that?
Correct.
Here's Dave Camp speaking last week with reporters. This was on Wednesday. As he, of course, the White House out with its own budget plans today and some interesting tax proposals there that we'll look at as well. But here was Dave Camp talking with reporters as he unveiled his tax overhaul.
We must enact real, meaningful tax reform to get this economy back on track. So today I'm releasing what a simpler, fairer tax code that leads to a stronger economy actually looks like. and more importantly, what that can mean for America's families and job creators. My plan is guided by one simple principle. When it comes to the tax code, everyone should play by the same rules. Your tax rate should be determined by what's fair, not who you know in Washington.
David K. Johnston, it's great to have you with us. Here's Dave Camp. Even the people in his own party are saying this is not going to pass, but it's a conversation starter, at least for us right here, right now. What do you think there? He describes it as simpler and fairer, leading to a stronger economy. What's not to like, David?
A lot. First of all, Jason gave a very good overview of this, but this is not reform. This is change or overhaul, but reform contains in it a suggestion of making things better, and many things here would not be better. For example, under this provision, the pipeline companies, the largest private infrastructure in the country, they would continue to force customers to pay their grossed-up federal income tax, and yet they don't pay that tax. They are exempt from it. He does nothing to fix that. He would reduce audits of partnerships. He would bifurcate the way hedge fund derivatives are counted. And my guess is that generally complexity is the friend of tax avoiders, and I don't understand why he'd do more of this. He is clearly part of a general attack going on about charitable contributions in this country in his proposal to reduce this. And most importantly, I think, this legislation would encourage companies to continue this practice of siphoning profits from their American pocket out of the country and bring them back, because if they did that, they could pay taxes on only 5% of those profits. That is unfair and unleveling of the playing field for domestic companies, which are mostly smaller companies, and it is an enormous encouragement to multinationals to game the system through these accounting devices. So while there are a lot of good things in here, there are plenty of bad ones.
Do you think the current system needs overhaul, David?
Oh, I think our current income tax system is completely and totally indefensible. I mean, I don't know anybody who favors our current system. But we need to – I think that real reform is you do this in the open. You have all open hearings. No piece of the legislation, not one word of it, goes in that isn't attached to a lawmaker who's responsible for it. And we stop this practice of working things out in private, having minimal public hearings. And my understanding is House Democrats had exactly zero input into this proposal.
Why do you think Republicans are not embracing it more avidly?
Well, I don't think there's any gain for Republicans politically in this at the moment whatsoever. Nothing is going to happen. The current split between the White House and House Republicans, there is no way the perfect bill would get passed. That if we had 100% agreement about it, I just can't see that being passed. And by the way, one of the effects of this bill, Tom, is it increases the child tax credit. Now, remember all the noise about the supposed non-taxpayers because people don't pay income taxes. They pay lots of other taxes. You increase that 50%, and the percentage of Americans who pay no income taxes will go up substantially.
That would be at the bottom of the income range, presumably.
Right now it's, I think, into the 40,000. A married couple with two children don't start paying income taxes until they're into the 40,000 plus income range. This would push them up higher.
Part of the reason that these things tend to stall out is it's so bewildering to try and wade in and figure it out. You go after what he does on how pipelines are taxed or not taxed, pipeline companies. But I'm reading here, on the other hand, that this would it would mean large tax increases for the fossil fuel industry on changing accelerated depreciation, percentage depletion. How's a civilian supposed to understand, David, whether, you know, your unhappiness with the pipeline taxing is offset right by cuts in the fossil fuel industry or increases in the fossil fuel industry taxation?
Well, this gets to the reason I don't call it reform. We have all these special rules for special industries depending on their – and this bill takes into account this legacy instead of starting with a clean sheet and saying, you know, we should treat microchips and potato chips the same way. That's the part of the underlying problem here is there are all these constituencies that are trying to be served and there will be winners and losers. I mean, if you're a retailer, you're not going to like this law because now instead of just deducting your advertising as an ordinary business expense, you'll have to amortize some of it over, I think it's 10 years. This bill is 900 pages long. You remember all the noise about the length of the Clinton health care plan, which I think was 1,400 pages? This is very complicated because partly we have a very complicated economy, but partly because it takes into account all sorts of interests instead of starting with a clean slate and saying, can we do this better? And we can do this better, but only if we do it in the open.
Jason, what would tax reform mean to you? Does this look like tax reform? Can we have that clean slate tax reform, or is that too much to ask of a great big country with a complicated economy?
You know, I think David makes a great point. And one, transparency is very important. All this should be done in the open. And he and I have the luxury of not having to go out and round up votes or be reelected or elected in the first place.
Yes.
And he, if he and I were doing this and we were given fiat, we would completely trash the code and start over. I totally agree with that. But in some ways, we have to go back to what is our fundamental we're trying to do. We're trying to have a tax code that doesn't discourage against savings and investment, that doesn't discourage job creation. That raises revenue, that also transfers money from those who have to those who don't, like the ITC. Because it's a balancing act, it is very, very hard to do tax reform. Dave can't get credit for putting this out. We should talk about it. I'd love to do a clean slate, but I think it's very hard to do because of what David points out with the winners and losers.
We are going to bravely wade on in here because we know our tax system just isn't right these days. Jason Fichtner, David K. Johnston, please stand by. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a GOP proposal to change the tax system, to simplify, get rid of a lot of write-offs, and what it would mean, talking about reforming the U.S. tax code. John Boehner talking last week about what Dave Camp put out there, not exactly throwing his arms wholly around it, saying, oh, that's a good place to start talking. Said, was it the Republican Party's plan? Well, no, not exactly. Here's Boehner.
Well, you're getting a little bit ahead of yourself. The chairman's going to outline a discussion draft to start the discussion about tax reform. We all know our tax system is broken. We all know that it, frankly, gets in the way of economic growth. And we've talked about this, and Chairman Camp's worked on this for years. It's time to have a public conversation about the issue of tax reform.
Does the president like the way the Republicans talk about it, the direction they would take it? Well, speaking Friday at the Democratic National Committee in Washington, he said no.
They just keep on offering a theory of the economy that time and again has failed America. They think we should give more tax breaks to those at the top and invest less in things like education and research. I'm not making that up. Go on their website. That's what they think.
The president on Friday in Washington. Jason Fichtner, does this go after research, the Dave Camp plan somehow? Would it undercut research investments?
Well, I think there's a bigger issue here. And listening to the president's speech, I'm sort of, in some ways, I get upset that there's so much partisanship in Washington. Leadership on both sides of the party aren't doing anything to help. You know, again, leadership means you go first. Mm-hmm. And Chairman Dave Camp's the one who's put his neck out here saying, let's have a discussion. He's not getting enough support from his party, and he's getting attacked from the left for doing things again. In an election year are very tough to do. But President Obama's talking about income inequality. And the Joint Committee on Taxation, which is the congressional scorekeeper for these legislative bills for revenue, and David and I are very familiar with these things. They do something called distribution effects that purport to show who wins, who loses by income class. And one of the things you see when you look 10 years out is that that group, the 10 to 20,000, the 20 to 30,000 group, those who get the expanded EITC, also
earned income tax credit, a little extra money from Uncle Sam when you work.
Yeah, so they will actually end up paying 50% less in taxes 10 years from now than they do today in the current law.
Under the Camp plan, you're saying?
Under the Camp plan. And this is where David gets to a point about they're taking more people off the tax rolls. So when Mitt Romney made that famous 47% are not paying taxes, they're not paying federal income taxes. This would increase it and in some ways exacerbate the problem we have where so many few taxpayers are paying for the variety or the majority of federal taxes. But this is where you get to the idea of populism. What has to go? What has to stay? Chairman Camp's also going after, in some ways, the executive compensation, which also President Obama's been saying. So his plan disallows businesses from deducting executive bonuses if they're paid in stock or they impose a 25% excise tax on compensation over $1 million that's paid for a nonprofit, which includes universities like George Washington, George Mason, Georgetown, mm-hmm. Boston University, Harvard. So he's trying to get some of this populism in by trying to get some equity. But again, the whole idea is, you know, so one person's tax break is another person's loophole. So we've closed one loophole. We're saying we're raising taxes on another. We have to do this balance, whether it's through R&D, depreciation schedules. You're never going to have a Pareto optimality where everyone wins. Someone's got to go. And what I would say when we talk about this, and David's very good at this in his writing too, where do we find things that are inefficient and are basically tax breaks that are unfair in the sense that they're not leveling the playing field or giving someone an advantage they shouldn't have? Let's focus on those first, reduce those, and broaden the rates. And that's where I think we do get some real reform, although it might be tweaking around the edges. I still think that's real reform.
David K. Johnston, speak then to distribution effects of our current tax system and how you see Dave Camp's proposal here, the difference in distribution effects.
Well, the study by the Joint Committee on Taxation shows that distribution would not be significantly altered. It'll be altered somewhat, but not in a way that does violence to the current rules, but are the current rules the rules we want to have. Between 1961 and 2006, which is the last time I ran the numbers on this, the tax burden of the 400 highest income taxpayers, that is on their tax returns, fell 60%, and their incomes grew so much that they were up $73 to 1 compared to ordinary Americans after tax. The tax burden of the bottom 90% of Americans fell less, not 60%, but 20, but that was all taken back with higher payroll taxes. So the bottom 90% were actually paying a larger share of their income than in 1961, 46 years earlier. I think we should keep in mind some fundamental principles of tax. 2,500 years ago, the Athenians figured out that the only reason you can get wealthy is because you live in a civilization, and the greater your gain, the greater burden you should bear, that is the higher percentage of your income you should pay back to the government so it will endure. We shouldn't lose sight of that principle that has survived all this time, and even George W. Bush supported that in principle. The original income tax was to capture what were called surplus incomes. It was not to tax the basic income you need to live on. And Adam Smith taught us clear back in 1776 that if you tax the basic income of people, all you do is force a rise in prices and a distortion. So income taxes should apply to people who have substantial incomes. One of the things this bill doesn't do, Tom, is address how the very, very wealthiest people can live essentially tax-free. They just borrow against their assets, and they end up with what I call incidental income. Warren Buffett is worth, what, $60 billion in the mm-hmm. latest Forbes report. He had $64 million of income one year. Now, do you really think he got one-tenth of 1% of his wealth as his income? It was money he had to take, companies that were sold for cash and things like that. Doesn't reflect his economic gains. And I think we need to think about that. We need to think about lifestyle, lifelong life cycle income. And I, again, think we need to start with a study of should we repeal the corporate income tax and come up with a different way of taxing corporate gains. I think that should be the most fundamental ground-laying piece is to look at should we tax corporations, since the majority of them now are flow-throughs. The profits flow through and the losses flow through to the investors.
Jason, take that back kind of the essentials here. I've heard Dave Camp's proposal described as anti-privilege, pro-competition populism. What's in there that justifies that label?
Well, I think what you see going on right now is there's a lot of, and David points this out too, there's a lot of special interest for people for corporations that benefit from one thing or another from the tax code. And Dave Camp's trying to do this. He's trying to remove and eliminate the credit for producing oil and gas from marginal wells. He's going after oil recovery credits. He's limiting deductions for energy-efficient commercial buildings, alcohol use, fuel. There are a lot of things. You know, you see the race car NASCAR gets a tax break. He's trying to go after all those things that basically lobbyists lobby for and get basically a lot of wealth off of for certain small individuals. But by doing those provisions in the tax code, the rest of us have to pay for it through higher rates. And David makes a great point, which I think we should go back to, because not a lot of people who are considered more on the left side or populist side are actually willing to do this. So I give David credit for mentioning it. Should we be taxing corporations? From an economic standpoint, corporations don't pay taxes. People do. You pay it through lower wages, higher prices on consumer goods, or a lower return on capital. And as David points out, there's now a lot of pass-throughs. So maybe we should look at, in some ways, not trying to tax the corporation, but tax the individuals who receive the income in some ways. And I think that's a great place to start real tax reform, is how do we really tax the income that corporations make once it's distributed on to the individuals.
When this is described as anti-privilege, where's that going? I mean, lawyers, doctors, CPAs would pay more here. Big and mid-sized professional firms with a major tax increase, I'm reading here. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, because the surtax, and this is also a point, you look about, David talked about the top 400. I think that changes so much every year. They're not the same people, but go to the top 1%. And these are people who are really making around $400,000 a year, give or take. But this top 1% is responsible for about 40% of all the federal income taxes. And these are the top earning lawyers, doctors, physicians, Hollywood moguls, lobbyists. Okay. And for those people who are, again, earning $400,000 a year single or $450,000 for married, there's this 10% surtax that's called on income. So the idea is to go in some ways after those people who can afford to pay more, can bear more of the burden. You may not like the idea that you're going from a 25% rate to 35%, and that marginal effect actually could harm some businesses and some individuals. But again, if they're making that much, they probably can afford it. And if they're paying more, that allows us to bring rates down for everybody else. And I think that's where Dave Kemp's trying to balance out the economic efficiency argument from the populist equity, raise more taxes.
So 25% the top rate, but then this 10% surcharge for people at, what, 450 and above, which would take it to 35. That's still lower than the top rate now. But is it after the deductions that would be ruled out, Jason?
Well, you still have what basically called the marginal versus the effective tax rate. So the effective is your average when you start adding in deductions. But the margin is where economists focus on, because the margin is what you get taxed on the next dollar. And so you think about, even at a 35% rate, I'm in D.C., you're in Boston, David's in New York, three areas that are very, very high state taxes. I think I'm close to 10% here. Now I'm at 45% if you add in federal and state. When you start getting to that point where you're taking 50% of the next dollar, people start curtailing their activities. Or they shift income. So David will say that corporations move it overseas. Warren Buffett will try to get it through capital gains instead. And Dave Kemp changed the capital gains taxes on this as well. So it has an exclusion of 40%, and then the rest of it's taxed at ordinary income. So he tries to capture that. So for high-income individuals, capital gains rate actually goes up by a percentage point. Not a lot, but a little bit. That makes a big difference.
And higher-income employees would have to pay, what, 10% on employer-provided health insurance? They'd have to pay a 10% surtax on retirement plan contributions from their employer.
Yeah, and this is where the 401k, I'm a little mixed on some of the savings incentives. So I've been on your show before, and I've said publicly I'm a big fan of savings incentives. I think we do have a problem in this country with a lot of people aren't saving enough, especially at the lower end. And what this does is it changes. There's still, you can deduct up about a little over $17,000 a year into a traditional 401k plan, which is tax deferred. It's taken out of your paycheck. You put in a savings account. When you retire, it's taken out and taxed. There's also something called the Roth IRA, which is you take after-tax money today. So it's already been taxed, and you put that, but you're not taxed when you take it out. What Kemp's plan does is he actually puts a limit on this of $8,750 that you can put into a traditional plan. Anything above that goes into a Roth. Because you're basically avoiding a tax deduction today, that's income into the Treasury today, and it scores a tax increase. But that does nothing for the lower end. And I think this is an area where I would have liked to have seen Chairman Kemp reach out to the Democrats and President Obama and say, let's increase the savers credit or something to go after low-income individuals so they actually have more of an incentive to save.
To help them save as well. Let's go to our listeners. Joe's calling from Colquitt, Oklahoma. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you, sir. I'm 60-year-old. Work like an animal all my life, pay taxes all my life.
Bless you.
These guys are starting at the top. You know, it's just like Obama giving that $700 billion to the top. If he had gave that to the working class, we'd have took it to Walmart, and we'd be okay right now. Mm. That's what we do. We spend our money. We don't save it.
Yeah.
But spending money is what makes this thing run. But instead, he put it back to the millionaires and billionaires, and it's still laying there today, doing us absolutely no good. We're adjusting all these taxes around, trying to make all the pieces of the puzzle fit. We've got more people on welfare than we have in the working class. I found out yesterday that the welfare people draw more than the minimum wage people. So where's this taking us?
Joe, I appreciate your call. We're looking at tax reform. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. David, there's an American who works like an animal, paid taxes all his life. He feels like the brakes have gone to the high end, but he's also unhappy about the number of people who aren't working at the bottom of the economy, but yet drawing safety net support from it.
Well, I'm not sure where he's getting any of these numbers. If he's the $700 billion is referring to the bailout of Wall Street, that was done by the Bush administration. We have repealed welfare as we know it under the Clinton administration. Certainly, the minimum wage in this country is much too low, and we need to restore the level it was in the 1960s when I was a minimum wage worker, by the way. His underlying point that what we have are generally policies that are redistributing upwards, that's been a fundamental theme of my books and my work, that our political rhetoric is that we tax people at the top to benefit people at the bottom. What I've shown from the official record is no, that's not what's going on. What's going on is the concentration of income and wealth at the very top through these government programs nobody knows about. That's why I brought up the pipeline item.
Mm-hmm.
It's only 3 cents a day per American, but if you're one of the handful of people on the receiving end, it's several billion dollars a year that goes into your wealth. And in that sense, yeah, we need to have a fundamental discussion about the value of work, what we pay for it, the inefficiency of our sick care system. We spend $2.64 per capita to the $1 spent on average by the other 33 modern economies in the world, and they all have universal health care.
When this is described, when Dave Kemp's plan is described as anti-privilege, pro-competition populism, do you agree, David?
Well, I think it is pro-competition, perhaps not as much as I'd like because I'm a very big fan of competition and dislike monopolies and oligopolies intensely. I'm not so sure it's anti-elite. It doesn't stop the practice of borrowing to live on your assets. It encourages siphoning money out of the country. It has a number of other provisions. It could be much more so. A little thing about numbers. The top 1% starts at around $400,000. The top half of 1% at 6. But the people in the top tenth of 1%, that's about 2 million and up, they make as much money as the bottom roughly 140 million Americans. That's almost half of us. And the tax system should reflect this enormous concentration of wealth at the very top. I don't want to discourage people from making money. And by the way, my response to a higher tax rate is, oh, how do I make more money so that I can be better off? Not, oh, I'll stop working. But we do need to think about how do we get an economy that rewards more people for the work and the contribution that they make on the margin.
And maybe that's here and maybe that's not. Jason, what about living off borrowing, as David describes? Does Dave Kemp go after that?
Well, I'm not as familiar with that provision as David is. What I will say is, and I think David will make this point with me, the more complexity you have in the tax code, where ideally, and David and I, if we started from scratch, we'd probably say all income should be taxed the same. We shouldn't make a distinction between earned income and non-earned income. But when you start having all these provisions that allow for special treatment, you give a lot of incentive for wealthier people to find ways to avoid paying tax and having lawyers and accountants, and that's what we still were going to have with this plan.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a GOP proposal to change the tax system, to simplify, get rid of a lot of write-offs, what it would mean. Dave Kemp, Republican of Michigan, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, put it out there. The reception, well, here was the House Speaker, his fellow Republican John Boehner, not too eager to get into the details. Listen to his first phrase here.
Blah, 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 blah. Listen, there's a conversation that needs to begin. This is the beginning of the conversation. The idea of tax reform is to get our economy going again, provide better, more economic growth, more jobs, and higher wages. The way you do that is you bring down rates. And to bring down rates, you clean out a lot of the garbage that's in there and the special interest issues that are in there. And so I think we ought to have a real conversation about this, and this is the beginning of that conversation.
Okay, maybe we'll have it, but you begin to get into it, and you heard him there, blah, 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 blah. Here was the president, this was last Wednesday in St. Paul, Minnesota, outlining his plans for infrastructure investment. But, of course, that, he said, would have to come from an overhaul of the tax code.
We'll pay for these investments in part by simplifying the tax code. We're going to close wasteful tax loopholes, lower tax rates for businesses that create jobs here at home, stop rewarding companies for sending jobs to other countries, use the money we save in this transition to create good jobs with good wages, rebuilding America. It makes sense. It makes sense.
Easy to talk about tax reform, tax overhaul, hard to do. David, we've heard for years from Democrats in particular, but not only, about a tax code that led to jobs being sent overseas. Would Dave Camp's proposal change that, David?
I think it has the potential to make it worse. I mean, this is a 900-page bill that I have read through, and certainly
bleary-eyed.
I'm far from fully understanding what's in there. But let me challenge a fundamental point we just heard about lower tax rates create jobs. So imagine you own a company and you suddenly discover you have $1 million extra profit at the end of the year you didn't anticipate. If the tax rate is 25%, you're likely to say, I'll give the government its $250,000 and take all that money. If the tax rate were to be 50%, you might say, you know, sounds like a good time to buy some new trucks or improve that production line.
Lower that profit but have more trucks
And when you withdraw money from a business, you're destroying jobs. When you reinvest money in the business, you're creating jobs. And our tax code, because of these low rates, I believe, and I understand this is not the orthodox view of this, but I've spent many, many lunches talking to wealthy manufacturers and other business owners where I'm not directing the question at the tax code. I'm asking about how they run their business. And I repeatedly have learned as a practical matter that high tax rates encourage reinvestment in the business. So while I've said we should study limiting the corporate income tax, at the same time, you know, a higher corporate income tax might actually be job creating.
Jason Fichtner, what about the issue of profits overseas and jobs overseas? Would Dave Camp's proposal change the way those look?
You know, I'm mixed. There's some modifications. There's a plan to move it more to a territorial tax system where you tax basically income earned in the U.S. and not overseas, which could in some ways more people move corporations to have more money overseas. But if you lower the rates, it could encourage them to keep it here. I feel the opposite of David. I think high tax rates discourage investments. What you see is more complexity and gimmicks in the code. When you have high tax rates, you have lobbyists going and saying, give us a deduction now for producing oil and gas. Give us accelerated depreciation. Give us, so we can lower our tax rate. Imagine a world, just for your sixth, where you had a zero corporate tax rate. That means companies would then make investment decisions and hiring decisions just based on profit, not based on taxes. Way too often now, people make decisions on taxes, not profit. I work doing transfer pricing for major corporations whose sole operation is basically try to figure out how to lower and minimize their global tax operations. You're paying accountants, lawyers, and economists like me a lot of money to have them minimize their tax rates. If you lower the rate, then it's no longer profitable to search for tax deductions. And I think that's the important thing about how we create jobs. And Dave Camp does do that. And if that happens, maybe more jobs actually stay here. But you have to see how this plays out. They did a dynamic score, which I don't want to put my hat on too much. But the thing is, even the joint tax fan dynamic score says this would create more jobs if it lowers the rates and has money stay here so people can invest it, including businesses.
One interesting place it puts the brakes on very much at home is on flipping houses, buying and selling quickly for that quick hit of profit there. It would exclude from taxable income most capital gains on a principal residence, so you wouldn't pay on whatever you made on the growth and the value of your home. On the other hand, it would only allow that to be used once every 5 years. So much for house flipping. Rosa in Charlotte, North Carolina. Rosa, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
I'm so glad I'm able to speak about this particular subject. I live outside of Columbia, South Carolina.
Okay.
It's a very poor state. The jobs that go overseas, and I live in mill country, or what used to be mill country.
Yeah.
The big corporations are sending the jobs overseas. They're making mega bucks. In their own state, the minimum wage, I mean, the people are paid such a low rate. And Boeing, who has come to South Carolina, is producing an inferior product because they have an inferior worker, because South Carolina won't pay for training. When he spoke about the lobbyists, the fact of the matter is the lobbyists go to Congress, and Congress makes it happen for the contractors. Thank you so much.
Well, Rosa, we've got it. Oh, watch out for where the loopholes are created. Watch out for the lobbyists that work on them. Good luck to South Carolina. Nancy in Harrisonburg, Virginia. Nancy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have an idea that would help simplify taxes. It's so difficult to get any changes or improvements.
Yes, it is.
But if we could just raise the standard deduction at a one-time occurrence, that would eliminate a lot of taxpayers for having to itemize. Because the standard deduction would be higher, so that would have the effect of simplifying taxes for many.
So what would you raise it to, Nancy?
Pardon?
What would you raise it to, that standard deduction?
Well, I was just thinking, like, I don't know. That would be up for discussion, the amount. But I was thinking, like, I'm $5,000 or something like that. And then, so people wouldn't have to itemize. They'd have a benefit by using the standard, and their taxes would be simplified.
Nancy, I appreciate you bringing your mind to bear on it. David K. Johnston, what about it? Just crank up that standard deduction to $5,000. You'd have instant simplification for a lot of people. What would the impact be, David?
Well, in fact, CAMP raises the standard deduction roughly double what it is today. But I think the more basic question to ask is, why do we have itemizing? Is it really a benefit to us? And what if instead we adjusted rates to recognize the effect of itemizing and we got rid of all this time? I'm a mostly self-employed journalist who teaches at a law school and a wife who's a CEO, and we have to devote a number of days, usually about three of them, to doing our taxes every year if we're going to take advantage of things. Let's just get rid of all of that. Now, that will put H&R Block out of business. That will put Jackson Hewitt out of business. It'll put a lot of small mom-and-pop tax preparers out of business. I'm sorry about that. I don't believe in doing make work.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, so if I can,
Jason,
if I can
please,
add to that,
yeah, please. Would this get rid of itemization? How much of that would go away under Camp's proposal?
So a lot of it would go away. In fact, I think Dave Camp uses some figure. I don't have it in front, but like 99% or 95% would no longer have to itemize. I think that's a great point. Nancy, the caller, you know, we could raise the standard deduction more than even what Dave Camp's proposing, with the idea of getting rid of itemized deductions, because they do create more complexity. They create more winners and losers. And Dave Camp in some ways tries to balance this off. For example, he gets rid of the alternative minimum tax. And I think one way in trying to pay for this was he actually gets rid of the deduction, again, an itemized deduction for state and local taxes. And if you think about California, New York, and New Jersey, those three states claimed over 36%, more than one-third of the deduction value for home mortgage state and local property. They also accounted for 37% of all AMT taxpayers. So if you reduce and get rid of the state and local property taxes deduction but raise the standard exemption and get rid of the AMT, you vastly simplify the tax code. And that's what Dave Camp's trying to do and what we should give him more credit for trying to do as well.
I'm reading here sort of liberal analysts saying you go after those deductions for state and local taxes. You are in effect going after blue states that spend more on their citizenry because they want more done for their citizenry, that's a partisan attack. What do you say to that, Jason?
Well, there's two points to that. One, again, it's a balance. You get rid of the state and local tax deduction, but you also get rid of the AMT, which also hits blue states. So you're giving one and taking from the other and trying to balance. The second is more of a philosophical equity issue. One of the callers from South Carolina called in. Mm-hmm. You have callers in Texas, Wyoming, Alaska, states that don't have income taxes, who in some ways now have to pay a higher federal rate to subsidize the benefits and services that are in
California,
New York, California, yep. Exactly, D.C. Is that fair? So in some ways, we should basically say state taxes are state taxes. That what you pay for state tax goes to your state services. If you want to pay for them, that's great, but don't ask others from somewhere else to pay for them as well.
Tom, if I could weigh
David,
in on
yes.
that. I would say the liberal attack is exactly true, and so what? When you live in New York, as I do, you have the opportunity to have services you don't get elsewhere. And you should pay for them. I mean, no question
Amen.
That the higher tax states are the higher income states, and they're the states that tend to reinvest in the future. The one thing that we should keep in mind at all times is that income can be an illusion. The object here should be to enhance wealth over time. Income is just an accounting device that we use. Just as Adam Smith taught us that, you know, money is not wealth. Productive capacity is wealth. And so, taxes will go up for people in New York and California. And many of those people don't get to deduct their state income and their local property taxes like me today because of the alternative minimum tax. So it's no change for them.
Let's go to Jim. Jim in Boston. Jim, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hello, Tom. Gentlemen, I'd like to comment, if you could, please, in the weeds, in the bill itself that Chairman Kemp has put forward, there is a capping on the on municipal bonds and how that would affect communities reinvesting in the future in bridges, schools, firehouses, police stations. If they cap municipal bonds, now they're tax-free municipal bonds, if they cap that, any percentage of that, what that effect would have on communities. I think that's part of the fight that's going to happen in the future here. And as a utility commissioner, I am concerned about it.
Jim, let us pick it up. I appreciate your call, Jim. Jason, I'm reading here from, this is a Forbes summary of the plan, but it says that high-income taxpayers would have to pay a surtax of 10% on their otherwise tax-exempt municipal bond interest. Our caller Jim's worried about that because it may, you know, it will. That means that borrowing rates would go up for state and local governments. He's worried about it.
Yeah, I think Jim makes a good point, but I'll use one of David's sort of lines, which is we have to start looking at this because of the so what factor. In some ways, we are subsidizing local borrowing through bonds by making their bonds tax exempt. And it's been in some ways a tax dodge for higher income people. Now, I'm not saying that having states and localities able to borrow at lower funds isn't a good wild investment. I think it is. But there are a lot of challenges to that now, too, just looking at Detroit. If the bankruptcy arrangement that goes through right now is being proposed, those who have bond holdings would see a haircut. That in the future is going to raise rates as well. I think we need to have a different sort of conversation when it comes to how we're financing state and local borrowing in general, and whether it should be done through the federal tax code, if there's another way to do it that's actually more equitable, fair, and efficient.
I mean, David, it's easy to say, so what, David, when you're not the utility commissioner, like our caller here, but when you've got streets and sidewalks and, you know, water lines to take care of, if this gets more expensive, quality of life can fall. Are there really no special breaks in our current tax code that are there for good reason?
There's a good argument for them. The problem is that over time, when you have a subsidy, it often shifts from who's collecting it being not the local government but the investors. And it's a fundamental problem with subsidies. I think Jason is exactly right. We need to rethink through how do we do this. Now, look, we have been consuming our infrastructure. We are choosing to be poorer in the future because we're not repairing, maintaining, and adding to the value we have in this public furniture of roads, bridges, sewer systems, et cetera. And we need to address that. But I think looking at the municipal bond aspect of this and that some very high-income people will pay a small tax is to watch the hole and miss the donut.
Agreed.
We're talking about the nation's tax system and a proposal to overhaul it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Okay, so here we are. John Boehner saying blah, 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 blah when people start to ask about the details of Dave Kemp's proposal. Everybody's saying it's DOA, dead on arrival, not going to happen. The president in his budget today talking about more earned income, tax credit breaks for childless workers, and talking about going after breaks on for wealthy taxpayers. But nobody's saying that this is really likely to happen on any front. Jason Fichtner, if you were to design, a game plan for getting our tax code actually changed politically, how would you do it?
Well, I would actually go back to the Simpson-Bowles plan we had a few years ago. They actually laid out three alternatives. Says, hey, we will basically get rid of most of these itemized deductions and special privileges. And if you do that, you can get a low 10% rate. Hey, if you want to keep home mortgage interest, the rate has to go up to this. You want to keep state and local property, it goes to this. And you make people realize the trade-offs they're making for higher rates versus deductions. And then you sell, like we've been doing today, sell a higher standard deduction, no itemized deductions, and lower rates. I think if you start with that message, more and more people will come on board, especially when you have people like David and me both agreeing that that's the way to go.
David, at which party could or should do that? And at what point in our political cycle would that be most likely to go? We see where Simpson-Bowles went.
Well, and Simpson-Bowles was not adopted by the commission. It's the plan of the two members. You know, we unfortunately are in an era where Republicans in the House decided and held meetings with some senators back in 2001 that they were never going to cooperate with a black man in the White House. And if it sounds like I'm accusing them of racism, I am. And the country has suffered badly because of this. When we reach the point at some point in the future where we have a Congress that wants to work to solve the country's problems with the president regardless of party, then we can get somewhere. In the meantime, we're stuck in the economic doldrums, and the only way to change it is to elect different people to office. And that's, after all, what democracy is about, is electing people who will advance our common interests and our self-interests.
Listeners, there's plenty to chew on the tax front and on the political front right behind it, because they are joined at the hip. I'm not sure how we walk out of this one.
I think we walk out by saying we give Chairman Camp credit for putting his neck out and having his conversation. That's a good way to
do it. I agree.
And I make three on that one, I guess. Good for him. He gets us talking, and this needs to be talked about. If you haven't done your taxes yet, you'll be reminded soon enough of just how badly we need reform. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. Jason Fichtner at the Mercatus Center, George Mason University. Jason, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
David K. Johnston, look for his book, Divided. He's edited. It comes out next month. David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for all your input as well. As always, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.